Good morning, everyone. Thanks for coming to the March 13th, 2022 session of Personal Theology of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Berkeley. This program has been in existence for over 40 years, and we are glad to continue the tradition. Before I introduce today's speaker, I wanted to read the Land Acknowledgement Statement. As we begin, we want to acknowledge that this church occupies land in Huchin, the unceded territory of the Chochenyo-speaking Ohlone people. We understand that we continue to benefit from the seizure and occupation of this land. We acknowledge and embrace our responsibility to take restorative action. We affirm that this is deeply felt and commit our congregation to be in right relationship with Indigenous communities, aligning in solidarity, supporting Indigenous projects, and caring properly for the land. Today's speaker is Jacob King. Some of you may remember that he spoke to us in November of 2020 when he was early in his start at Star King School for the Ministry, and he told us his personal journey and how he arrived at deciding to become a UU minister. Just a quick recap, as he grew up in Nebraska and attended conservative Christian churches in that area, with which I'm very familiar, and eventually made his way into the Army National Guard and served in Iraq. While stationed in Tucson, he and his wife attended the UU church in that area, and the light bulb went off and the stars appeared, and Jacob decided to apply to Star King School for the Ministry with the intended goal of becoming a military chaplain. So today we're going to hear where he is in his journey and hear about his future plans. So thank you for coming back, Jacob.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me, Anne and Ulan. I appreciate you guys putting this together. I enjoyed visiting the last time. Was it November 2020? So it's been a bit of time since then, but I haven't forgotten the experiences, and I'm glad to participate in this once again. So last time I spoke with you all, we had been in the pandemic for, it was 8 months, 6 to 8 months around that time, and I had only been in seminary for 8 months at that time. So I started my seminary journey in the pandemic. So that was switching to all online learning when I was expecting to be in person for most of it. And then obviously most of the course material was switching to address the real life, real-time traumas that were occurring, and people were facing isolation on a grand scale we've never experienced before. So chaplaincy was high demand, ministry was in high demand. And so after November, the purpose of these theologies is it's personal theology, it's in the name. So we're building upon foundations. As Jesus says, you can't build a house without digging the foundations first. And so that was what the first year of seminary was intended to do. Star King for the first year kind of gives the same classes to all students, regardless of faith background. You get a little bit of an introduction to other faith traditions, another introduction to spiritual practices across faith traditions, a introduction to the commitment of social justice work, so how to interconnect with other agencies, and then a little bit about Unitarian Universalism, because you don't have to be a UU to go to Star King, but it is by nature a predominantly UU seminary. And so that was that foundational work. Starting in January, after that second year, that's when you can kind of curtail the schooling to meet your needs. So I recognized I was pursuing chaplaincy, so I took some courses oriented towards that, which were very formative. And I got to experience other world traditions I never got to really experience growing up. So I took some courses on Buddhism and a course on Islam that I really quite enjoyed. Obviously, I, like many other students at Star King, are also being formulated not just in school, but most of us are also working full time. And so most of our employment is also formulating while we're studying and receiving the materials. And so as many of you are aware, around that time I was working at the sheriff's office, but it was around that, around January. So I had been at the sheriff's office for a year, and I had joined with the intent of, through a UU lens, seeing if we can implement change. And I still believe that that change can be implemented, but I was really struggling with what I view it as a broken system. We hear it every year that the criminal justice system is broken. And I had studied in my undergrad, I took criminology and criminal justice courses, but there's a difference between reading it and then living, getting to live the experience. We were every day, we were sending people to jail for the crime of stealing food to live, and then taking people to jail and having them released 4 hours later after they harmed a loved one. It was, to me, there was this interesting juxtaposition of what were we doing here? The mental institution, psychiatric care institutions were always overflowed. And so during my time in, I was going through police academy at the time, they shared with us the horrible statistic that the largest psychiatric care facility in the US is actually the LA County Jail, which has 53,000 adults in custody who would meet the standard of care to be in a psychiatric care facility, where they would obviously most likely receive better care than an environment as a jail. And I got to experience that firsthand, where in Oregon, there's about 4,000 individuals who would meet that standard, but there's only 1,000 beds available. And so most of those people remaining are not living at home or living in facilities, they're living on the street. And so most of the individuals we were responding to for reports of crimes, because when people see something going wrong, they're not knowing all the background. They're just doing what any other individual would do. Hey, this person's trying to break in to this convenience store at 3 a.m. But dealing with those individuals, it was really hard for me to balance the duties that the law enforcement required, and obviously the compassionate care that I had for UU, as there was no right solution. We tried all the alternatives of taking them to the psychiatric care facilities, only to be turned away because there wasn't beds, and the jail not having even psychiatric care professionals in the facilities at night. So you have someone being taken away from their position of comfort, thrown into a jail for 12 hours, and they're not even really going to receive any medical attention until 10 a.m. the next morning. It's just, for me, it was a little bit too much. And so in February, I received the ability to activate with the National Guard for COVID response missions. And I respectfully resigned from my posting with the sheriff's office. Maybe one day I'll return to that environment with a different lens. But for me, that was just kind of I got the formation that I needed out of it, but I realized I needed to put my efforts elsewhere at that moment. Moving into the February to May timeframe, so I've been February 2021, that was when the vaccines first came on the scene. So the vaccines had been released for about a week before, like many states, they activated the National Guard to help facilitate the logistical difficulties of making vaccines available for 360 million adults and children. At the start of that mission, there was so much up in the air as, like everywhere else, the vaccines were created, but no one really knew. There wasn't facilities in place to make that many. So there was only, now there's batches of hundreds of thousands coming out at a time. At the start, there was only batches of hundreds. And at the start, it just happened during that time, I was taking one of the classes on showing inequalities in our society. And at the start, as many of you experienced, the vaccines were anything but equitable. We were supporting sites where the Oregon Health Authority did a really great job of trying to make sites available in areas of BIPOC and indigenous populations. However, it was quickly realized that people were showing up to those facilities and taking a spot because they knew how to navigate the complex online systems from groups that weren't from that area. So you would have wealthy upper class individuals all of a sudden in the middle of inner city care facilities here for a vaccine. And we were dealing with that on the call line of, it wasn't our place to necessarily determine if someone was met the criteria, if they could get it. But we would report all of that to the Oregon Health Authority, say, hey, you told us you wanted to give a site predominantly oriented towards African-American and BIPOC groups, and everyone we've signed up in the past week has been white. And how do we address that? And obviously you're balancing it from the military perspective, is we were just told to get as many people vaccinated as we can. But then the UU perspective is, this isn't right. This doesn't meet anything of what we're trying to aim for. And many of my service members were struggling with that, as they were getting told by people, how do you teach an 18-year-old to handle a 70-year-old crying to them on the phone, telling them that by them not telling them where to get a vaccine, they're going to die the next day. Like, no 18-year-old is ready for that. And so we had chaplain support available, and I was able to help coordinate that and get them that, because there is that vicarious trauma that even counselors can receive, chaplains can receive, ministers are received. None of us are exempt from that. And so kind of stuck between a hard rock and a hard place of meeting the military needs. But what we ended up doing to work around what we were viewing as an injustice in the system is we reached out to the professionals. So we reached out to the American Civil Liberties Union. They have a local chapter. We reached out to various African-American oriented groups, various indigenous groups, and told them, hey, these clinics are not working at the moment. Maybe you guys can put something together with the Oregon Health Authority. And it took a while, as most things in the social justice field does. Just it's a marathon, not a sprint. But by March or April, they were putting these sites together. The J&J vaccine had came around that time, and people were more receptive. That was the other part we were running into, is the historical trauma trying to reach these groups. We had people calling in from historically marginalized groups saying, hey, I don't trust getting this vaccine from a doctor that doesn't look like me. And we might not necessarily understand that, but we were having people referencing things like the Tuskegee experiment, all manners. And I had never really experienced that personally before. I did not grow up ever fearing of going to a different medical clinic, but I didn't grow up with that generational trauma. And so for them, it was purely logical. And so trying to not only navigate where they're supposed to get a vaccine, but how do we navigate that they're going to get a vaccine from someone that looks like them? And so once again, it's just like everything, you just work with what you have. So we reached out to those counterparts again, and they, lo and behold, by April, they had the clinics not only oriented towards those groups, but staffed by nurses and doctors that were of that particular group they were targeting. So it wasn't anything necessarily thinking outside the box. It was just working with what we had available. But in the end, I think by April, we had got 60,000 people from those groups vaccinated who otherwise would not have most likely received the vaccine for quite some time. And so the foundations that I learned from that is, when there's always going to be times of crisis, and UUs are naturally drawn to crisis periods. I mean, our first casualty in the civil rights movement happened in Selma, so under the Reverend James Reeb. So we're not indisposed or ignorant of these crises when they occur, but it's the transcendentalists didn't really care for most institutions, but we are in a institutionally based world, and yes, we can change it over time, but we're in times of crisis. We don't have 6 months to try to have these agencies commit massive reform, but we can get creative with reading between the lines, their own policies, reaching out for support. And even if we don't necessarily agree with everything that institution does historically, our values compel us to put the needs of people over our own necessarily specific misgivings. And so that's what we learned from that. So February to April, it was actually technically May. Dealing with that, balancing my own need, obviously UUs were very passionate when it comes to that work. But it realized after 30 days of me working 90 hours a week and being told, being command directed to take a 4-day vacation, that we're also having to balance the work-life balance and also balancing how much effort we're putting in to a certain activity. Yes, we can spend 90 hours a week doing social justice work. However, is that sustainable for our long-term health? Is that going to keep us in this realm for the next 20 years? And I think I learned a statistic around that time that most people entering the ministry left the field after 3 to 4 years. That doesn't mean left the field and one day returns. That meant left the field never to return. So for most of you that might not be as familiar with the process, most faith traditions, it's a 6 to 8 year process to become ministerial ordained. And so the statistics were showing that it was taking twice the time for people to become ministers for them to actually stay in the field. And that's why you've seen in some recent UU posts and on the Twitter page, they're revamping the self-care aspects, the balancing. Some people felt like they weren't doing enough, but just by supporting your congregations, you are doing enough. Each congregation regionally has some social justice work they're supporting. Tucson, from my experience, like No Las Muertes, a lot of the Northwest region, they're supporting stopping coastal erosion activities. And so you are supporting the EU values and social justice work just by being with the congregations. It's not all of us have the abilities to go march to Washington, but we do have the abilities to continue to support both ministers, congregations, either financially or even doing stuff like the volunteers for the coffee hours, or the volunteers that come twice a year to do building maintenance projects. I mean, those are all part of the interconnected world that is UU. And so as most of the life. So it goes from one thing to another. So I got off those orders May 14th. And by that point, it was kind of a dual function. As many of you know, I had a bunch of trauma that I shared with from the last session, and a condition of me to become a chaplain, both a chaplain candidate, that is, so a chaplain in training, which is a job in the military, but the UUA and the military both required me to go through about a year and a half of mental health counseling. And it was, for me, the barrier was that anonymousness piece. A lot of the VA care, when you go through counseling treatment, it's not private. Those records get shared with the Army. And so that's why I was always hesitant to always receive care. And obviously I had that historical religious trauma. So I appreciate the work chaplains did, but I never felt comfortable going to the chaplain. It just happened to be a blessing that I ended up in the area where I was, where the only facility in the country that the VA has that is anonymous care is called the Vet Center. So they're expanding that in other areas, but it's oriented towards combat veterans, which I had never been through combat. I'd been exposed to combat and I had mortars near me, but I had never had to be in direct combat. But they noticed in my conversations, they said my eyes fluttered, which they said was a sign of reliving flashbacks that they were experiencing predominantly with combat veterans. So even though I hadn't been through combat, I had never noticed my eyes fluttering. Obviously, introspection only goes so far compared to sitting in a formal session, but a year and a half of that completely life-changing. I no longer was unable to sleep at night. I was no longer having flashbacks during the day or bouts of time where I would be thinking about a topic for 4 hours on end of something from my past. And for me, it was really just repowering. We talk about in UU traditions reclaiming quite a bit. And for me, it's not that the trauma went away. Obviously, there are still traumatic incidents, and everyone has trauma. It's just different layers and different experiences. But for me, the trauma was no longer controlling me. I now controlled the trauma. I could think back on the situations and not go into a flashback. I could just recognize this is what happened. It was outside my control, but here's what we're going to do going forward. So around March, I was formally not ordained, but I was given permission to become a candidate. So I commissioned as an officer. I had spent 6 years as an enlisted soldier, became an officer during that COVID mission. And then after the mission in May, I got to go to the Army Chaplain School in South Carolina. So it's near it's an hour away from Charleston, but going to that school had always been the goal from the beginning. So that was a big, when you ordain as UU, you have the UU requirements, but when you're ordaining for military chaplaincy, you have to meet Army requirements as well. It's why the MFC in the last year or so has added an addendum for those pursuing military chaplaincy that they can receive preliminary ordainment without necessarily meeting all the steps, as long as they meet it within 7 years, because there is quite a bit. And one of those requirements for the Army was to go through this chaplain school. And going there, I went with an open mind. I recognized the realities that I was probably going to be the only UU there. And 95% of the Army Chaplain Corps is some form of evangelical Christian. That's just the reality. And I was not actually the only UU there. There was another Reverend, John Smith, with me there, which I was not expecting. But I remember, as I mentioned, that reclaiming, I had gone through a year and a half of dealing with physical, emotional trauma that had been enacted through my livelihood. And as I mentioned, the flashbacks stopped and the eyes fluttering stopped. But I realized that they had not taken care of all the triggers, because what triggered me was outside of their lens of professional scope. And it was walking to my first day of class at the U.S. Army Chaplain School, and in big bold letters across the entry door, it says, "The fear of the Lord is beginning of wisdom." Fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And so that was I had gotten to class an hour early, and I immediately walked away from those doors and had to take a moment, because in that moment, it didn't bring up any of the physical traumas or the emotional traumas. It had brought up purely spiritual, moral traumas from growing up in an environment where I was, if you don't believe this way, everyone is going to go burn in some eternal torment for the remainder of their lives. And you have to be straight. You can't be gay or bisexual. Otherwise you'll face those torments as well. And you need to be fearful of the divine creator. There's no love involved. Like, to me, that I realized in that moment that when I say it's outside of their scope is the counselor I had, he was a religious man, but that wasn't the purpose of the counseling. So there was no religion in any of our discussions. So I had dealt with the physical and emotional trauma, and I realized I hadn't dealt with the spiritual trauma. I wasn't even aware necessarily of the separation and distinction. And so now here I was back into essentially the evangelical environment that I had excluded myself from 5 years. And I had been in seminary by 2 years by this point. I still hadn't read the Bible in 5 years. And so that was our first day of class as we were discussing verses from the Bible. So after 5 years, that was my first experience reopening the Bible after reading that sign on the door. Besides that experience, there was others like it of just people didn't understand necessarily the Unitarian Universalism side of things. I had to get instructors involved with some of my classmates who were deeply apologetic that I believed what I believed. Like that they were literally having prayers for believing what I believed. And I was like trying to explain to them, like, for one, it wasn't just Christians in the room. There was an Islamic student in the room who I grew to become great friends with. And obviously there was another UU like me who joined the course about a week or two after. But I had to really test the limits of like, what did I view as my faith tradition? Because at the first few weeks, I was wondering, what am I doing here? What am I doing in this environment? Is this really, really what I want? And while balancing dealing with individuals who most of them had never been in the military before, so they didn't really necessarily get the gist that military chaplains are there for all service members. Yes, you have to get ordained by a faith tradition, but it doesn't matter what faith tradition the service member you're helping, you help them. You might draw upon your own religious experience, but if they're needing literature or guidance from another faith tradition, if it's outside your scope of experience, you're there to help facilitate getting someone with that experience. And so two of the service members actually left the course and the army entirely because they couldn't get that. And that just kind of springboarded off from their discussions with me, which is not what I was intending to do. But the reality is, if you can't speak with a peer of equal religious training in a respectful or professional manner, how are you going to go speak with the service member who tells you, yeah, I don't believe in God? Like, there's gotta be some fine limit and balance. But outside those first 3 weeks, the remainder of the course is I grew quite fond of it. I got to learn from other traditions that I'd never really got to experience. There was three rabbis in the course. And so getting to speak with these, most of them were 50 years old. So they're drawing upon not just not religious knowledge, but obviously life experience, and getting to know their interpretations of kind of the Old Testament. And then obviously I had the Islamic fellow who I really enjoyed. We had great talks about the historical rise of Islam, Battle of Yarmouk, just the sheer unexpectedness of Muhammad being able to unify his people from oppression and spread it into one of the largest empires of all time. And obviously now it's a faith tradition that is the second or third largest on planet Earth. I mean, it's small beginnings to complete world changing. And the course did offer a lot of fundamentals that have kind of shaped the way I go about chaplaincy. It really focused a lot on clinical counseling. So it clinical counseling from a moral injury and spiritual realm, not just the emotional or dealing with physical trauma, which is what clinical counselors are for. And they really stress that relationship. Most units now in the Army, they have both on hand. They have a chaplain on hand and a trained clinical counselor, because if you're looking at the holistic approach of an individual, which you never would think that term would be used in the Army, but now there's a entire field manual and regulation called FM7-22, Holistic Health and Fitness. And so now I get to bring that into conversations with 60-year-old commanders who would never think of that term ever being in the Army, but now it's a regulation, so they can't argue against it. And other items in the course we did, I really enjoyed having to come to terms with, yes, I'm a UU, But most of the service members I'm going to be dealing with, it's either going to be atheist or they're going to be Christian, and it's going to be Trinitarian Christian. And to me, that was perfectly okay. A lot of the course, we went to a different service every week, so it didn't have to be from our own. They wanted you to go to other services. So I went to other Christian services I'd never been to. I got to go experience Anglicanism, Lutheranism. I went to a couple Latter-day Saints, had a great experience there. And it helped when it came to, we did a lot of practicals. So you were given scenarios. Here's what you need to deal with. And most of them were traditional Christian oriented, but I was able to draw upon those. And I started to grow comfortable referencing biblical texts. I knew the texts. It didn't take me rereading necessarily to have to relearn them. It was, I had just buried them so deep just from my trauma that I had never felt comfortable bringing them out. And as time progressed, and I also took advantage of recognizing that I still had that trauma. My school, Star King School for the Ministry, had a chaplain on hand who, she happened to be a military chaplain as well. And so about once a month we were meeting to discuss these moral and spiritual injuries. And it was not an easy journey. It felt like I was going through therapy all over again, just of a different nature. But in the end, I was able to successfully complete the course. My peers had a greater respect for Unitarian Universalism, just based on the actions of me and the other you showing them. We did give a bunch of services as well. All the chaplains were encouraged to give faith services outside class hours, so their course mates could experience. And while that might not necessarily change some of their perspectives on members of the LGBTQ community or other matters that the EU supports, at the very least, it gave them a different degree of respect towards it. And I think that's when we're trying to balance that seventh principle, we have to recognize we're not going to change necessarily the faith or religion of others, but we can definitely reference things, especially from the Bible. The second greatest commandment, love the neighbor as yourself, doesn't say you have to like them. At no point does it say you have to like them. I didn't like all my classmates, and it was definitely a test of patience to listen to some of their sermons, which were not as friendly towards the LGBTQ community. But it's very clear in our Constitution, First Amendment rights for all. It is, if you deny the First Amendment rights of some, you deny it of all. But you can go about it in a respectful manner. If they're giving it in their own church, in their own sanctuary, that's perfectly okay. We give messages in our church and sanctuary that necessarily isn't appreciated by the wider world, but we live in a country where we don't have to fear about giving that message, like others of our faith tradition at the moment live in regimes that do not support those type of messages and live in constant fear to support those messages. I think by the end, the biggest takeaway that I received from my course is that UUs do have a place in the military chaplaincy. About 40% of 18 to 25 year olds in the U.S. identify as nun. It's the rise of the nuns, not stirring up Catholic imagery of a bunch of maidens running around. It's individuals who, some people hear the term nun and they think atheist. That's not what nun means. Nuns means when someone asks them, what's your religion? They usually respond, none at the moment. That doesn't mean they're not spiritual. That doesn't mean that they haven't come from a faith tradition. It means a large section of our society is in a constant state of healing. They grew up in a faith tradition they might not necessarily have agreed with. And it's not just Christianity is not just exempt. You can go to any social media pages, like Reddit is a great one. There's a subreddit for every religion. There's an X, there's an X Hindu, there's an X Mormon, there's an X Islam. Something in all of the world's faith traditions, for whatever reason, some people were either, they had some trauma with it, they had some disagreements with it, or they might not have been experienced any faith tradition. If you've never been experienced to a faith tradition, you grew up in a household that didn't religion wasn't really the priority. How can you be asked the question if you're atheist or not, if you were never even given the opportunity to expand or develop your own faith tradition? And so I say 18 to 25 year olds very specifically because the bulk of the US military is 18 to 25. That is the demographic that as chaplains, military chaplains were expected to serve. Yes, there's people outside of that age limit, but for the most part, it's 18 to 25 year olds, just got out of high school, haven't really had much life experience, don't really know necessarily where they're going. Maybe they start college just because everyone and their parents tell them to. But a lot of these young people who we got to meet at the course for training purposes, it was asking them like, what is your faith tradition? What is your religion? It was really awe-inspiring to hear the responses. A lot of times, like, I don't know was a valid answer. Like most teachers wouldn't necessarily accept that in a test environment, but where this is a religious environment, we should encourage the answer, I don't know. We've seen time and time again what the answer is. A firm response under any circumstances has done. I do enjoy reading about martyrs, but there are times where that is taken to a extreme level that is not should not be encouraged. But for the most part, these young people, it didn't bother them that they didn't know. That was the thing that struck me the most. I had grown up in an environment where I don't know is a scary thing, where for most of these young people, the I don't know was kind of a term of empowerment. It was basically, as John Locke says, tabula rosa. These unique individuals grew up doing the best they could, and now they are free as they move into this young adulthood to pursue whatever or not pursue at all. If they don't pursue any faith tradition, the reality is that's also perfectly okay. And you minister shouldn't say, yeah, don't pursue any faith tradition, but if that is what works best for them, I don't see any reason why that should not be encouraged. And as a chaplain, I also have reading materials for the atheist and agnostic service members as well. I can't even count how many books of Nietzsche I handed out, or Kafka. Coming back from that course, I continued with my once a month check-in. I quite enjoyed that with the chaplain, and it was within a week I had been assigned to a unit. So I am not a chaplain. I'm a chaplain candidate, which means I'm a minister in training, but the Army is short chaplains. We're supposed to be at 100% and we're at less than 20%. So there's, for reference, the way chaplains work in the Army is they get assigned to what's called a battalion. A battalion is about 500 to 1,000 service members and their families. So about the size, larger than many of our own congregations, is the foothold you have. And in the Army, there's tens of battalions without chaplains at all. And so sometimes you have chaplains covering more than one battalion, which, as you can imagine, is a logistical nightmare. So even though I am still in training, they gave me a supervisor who supervises 10 other chaplains and then assigned me to a battalion it's called a unit ministry team. So it used to be just a chaplain, and the Army recognized, you know, there's too many people, we need two people. So there's an entire job called Religious Affairs Specialist, which is a enlisted service member, 18 to 22, no college required. And they're just there to support the chaplain and whatever he needs. But obviously 18 to 22, you're dealing with the same client target population. This individual might just happen to be interested in religion more than the others, but it's not as much training as ministers. And so going to the unit that I went reported to had not had a chaplain in 4 years. And so most of the service members in the unit had never even seen a military chaplain. And so it's been a learning experience for me, in the sense of the only guidance I've been given is by a brand new commander who says, just be there for the soldiers. What does that mean? anyone can be there. Like, I can go stand at the sidelines at the football games. Is that being with the football players or what? But as we've already experienced UUs, we figure it out. So I've just gotten used to, I've never been at that level in the Army before. Recognize, like, I came from a level where you have 9 service members in your 1 unit, where now I'm free to go anywhere to speak with 600 service members. That's it's a much wider discrepancy. And a company is 100 soldiers. So in a battalion, we said it's 500. So you have 5 companies. And all of those companies might not be in the same area or even training at the same time. So it's not like a congregation where you can expect everyone will probably at least be here one of the Sundays this month. That's, you have to balance, how do we reach all these service members? Well, what have we been doing the last year and a half? We've been doing virtual emails, reaching millions of people across the world. And so I did not invent any of these. I've just been following all the lessons I learned from individuals like yourselves, is just sending emails to all, to give some message out, calling people, doing a lot of remote check-ins. That's one thing I never thought would work, is doing a prayer over the phone. I don't agree with everything Paul says, but the pray always thing seems to work for a lot of people. And I have done more prayers over the phone with people than I ever thought I would. And it's quite powerful, as I might not believe all the things they believe when I'm having that confidential counseling session with them. But in that moment of prayer, it doesn't really matter. I'm praying to help them, and they're receiving a spirit. That's the easiest way I can put it. The spiritual energy over these phone calls is something I've grown quite fond of. And I've quite enjoyed the experiences. I've enjoyed having to only supervise one person instead of 10, like I used to have to. It's a lot easier to keep track of one person. But I developing them, he's my religious affairs specialist. He's actually pursuing Druidism at the moment, which I've just absolutely proud of. I've helped get him literature, whatever he needs to help expand in that. And we happen to have a couple of Druids in the battalion. And so when it comes to balancing that as a team, I'm not as well-versed in that field as others, but I have a team member who is, and so we can reach out. We've reached out to those service members. We've given them literature, and that's just one thing UU has always been really good. If I can get any takeaway from everything, is that working together, even it's well within our principles. Like we said, the most important commandment is you don't have to like them, but you have to love them. And so I fully recognize I'm only one individual. I can't know or learn everything. If a Hindu soldier comes to me and has a question, I might not necessarily be as well versed, but I know in the Portland area I can find at least 5 of those religious institutions that would, I'm sure, more than willing to come out and speak with that service member or connect with them. I don't think I've ever had a church that I've called say, hey, I have a service member that needs help, would you guys be willing? I haven't been told no. I haven't been given a single no. It's usually they're more confused why I'm the first one that's ever called them. They were like, have you never had an Islamic soldier join the military? I'm like, well, no, but no one's ever asked the question. So I'm now in my third year. I'm getting closer. The entire purpose of this talk is, as you know, I got accepted into the UU Albany. I was not expecting to get in the UU Albany. I don't think I even originally applied to the UU Albany. I think I first applied to the UU Portland. But as they say, all things happen for a reason. And so I started my journey in Tucson. I moved to Oregon. Now I'm moving to be an hour away from Thoreau's cabin. But I think it's going to be a great formulative experience. I Oregon, what it has done for me is it has given me that spiritual and emotional healing that I needed. If I did not do both of those two things, I think I would have been in that statistic of after being ordained, of being out of the ministry within 2 to 3 years. Because I would be doing a disservice to others. As my state chaplain put it, it's if you're bringing your trauma onto them, how are you going to help them through their trauma? It's not a personal attack on me. They would expect the same for everyone. And so the three takeaways that I've gotten over this last year and a half is it's okay to ask for help. Jesus says, tells ministers to heal thyself, but he doesn't tell you how to go about it. So when it comes to, no one can force you to go through these sessions. It definitely takes a lot of willpower to ask for help, especially if you're of a stoic nature. And then it's okay to work with others you don't necessarily like. That'd be point number two. Like I said, I've still got colleagues in the chaplain corps who they just don't understand anything about UU, but hey, I'll still go to their services and they'll still come to mine. It's perfectly fine to get that exposure when I'm speaking with service members who either don't have a belief or don't know what they're believing or don't believe the things I believe. That's perfectly fine. It's what do they need to get through their trauma? If they don't need anything, that's great. That's the perfect time to see, could I offer them literature? Would they like a religious text from their tradition? Would they like readings about it? What can I do for them? And then the third thing is it's work learning to work with other institutions, even if we don't necessarily agree with everything that institution is. Obviously always the long term is we're always in this state of we're always in this state of changing the game. We've been in this business for 500 years now, and it's just been a constant state of there's always something. We definitely took it literally when Martin Luther King said an injustice anywhere is an injustice everywhere. So we definitely took that to heart, and that's perfectly okay. It's finding that balance of, yes, we want to support it, but we need to also balance our own, how many hours a week we're spending on it at the end of the day. Are we taking care of our basic holistic health? Are we still getting our 8 to 9 hours of sleep? Are we eating healthy? Are we spending time with family? Like we are not mindless automatons. We are social creatures. We have needs. And if I think there was a quote in one of the courses I was reading, it said he was living in his parish. He wasn't a UU as an Anglican minister. And he said, if I don't spend 3 hours a day praying, everything else seems to fall apart. Now, most of us would be very hard pressed to pray for 3 hours. But if that is what that self-care plan, if for you, your self-care plan is watching TV for 2 hours, if it's going for a walk for an hour, like it's whatever keeps you in coming to these sessions, whatever keeps you in your tradition, whatever helps keep you in this social justice interconnected community, at the end of the day, having you here, whatever it took to get to that point is a blessing in itself.
All right, I've been to church.
Yeah. Thank you, Jacob.
Oh my God, I am crying. I have been to church.
I'm just so impressed with how much you've done in what, less than a year and a half since we first heard your story. Before we did get to questions and comments, I just want to say thank you so much. And I appreciate how you approach everything with an open mind, you know, that you are willing to learn and incorporate new ideas. And I particularly appreciated your comment, as you use, we figure it out, and we do. So thank you for that. That's my new mantra for you use. Anyway, how about questions and comments? if you want to raise your hand in the chat function, that would be helpful. And we'll take folks in order that they raise their hand. So looks like David's there first.
Yeah, first, thank you very much, Jacob. That's a terrific talk. And it touched on a lot of interesting themes. One of which recalled to me the movie Hacksaw Ridge. I don't know how many of you all saw it, but it was a war movie about the Pacific, and the principal in it was a guy that wanted to be a chaplain. And his story seemed to parallel yours in some respects, his passion for doing good. And there's one point in the movie where he's trying to engage with his sweetheart. And he says to her, you know, with such passion, "I don't know how I'm going to live with myself if I don't stay true to what I believe. And I don't know how you could live with me either. I'd never be the man that I wanted to be in your eyes." And it's wanting to live up to expectations, wanting to be the man we want people to admire. And I was curious about how you resonated to that character, that person, and that character in the movie, and how your sense differs in similarities.
We had not an entire class, but we had the impact of that movie throughout military communities is just astonishing. So we actually had an inclusion of a talk on that discussion in the chaplain course. When you're in the, obviously there's times where the army makes people join the army that didn't want to join the army. There's where we're well past the point of the early days of Iraq where it was go to war, go to jail, that predominantly targeted BIPOC communities, unfortunately. But there, when you're in the military, you can request as a religious freedom of either, they changed the term of religion. I think I referenced it in my discussions on the FM 27-22 Holistic Health and Fitness. And it's, religion is no longer, it doesn't say definition of religion, Christianity. It says moral or ethical beliefs. Moral, ethical, spiritual beliefs. How vague is that? How many people in this room have a moral, ethical, or spiritual belief? I think I can go to any room and find someone with a moral, ethical, or spiritual belief at hope. But and so they can request to either, if the request is of a nature, so if they're PFC DOS, his issue is they were, like most people that were being forced into the army, he was being assigned to the infantry, which infantry is, I was infantry when I first started. Unfortunately, the role of infantry is very clear. It's, they are there to cause destruction. That is there. If you have a moral misgiving against that, that is where you could request that religious exemption. And our UU principles support both being for or against war. We clarified that in 2010 at one of the general assemblies that people can have the moral right, as most of us would view war as a last resort or view it with abhorrence, but we have seen throughout history, I mean, Hitler wasn't going to stop exterminating generations of people without military intervention. There was no diplomatic solution to that. Just like Phil Pot, there was no stopping that without direct intervention from Vietnamese military, which people forget. They stopped Phil Pot. So the thing with DOS that I really liked is he found that balance with, they eventually agreed to let him become a combat medic without the weapon. So most combat medics, you have to have a weapon. Chaplains, some of us, We're actually, chaplains are considered non-combatants and so legally cannot carry a weapon. That's why we have the religious affairs specialist with us who can. But yeah, great. Desmond Doss, quite a true testament. I appreciate you sharing his words on how could he live with himself if he wasn't true to character. And unfortunately, not everyone is of a mindset of to be outspoken as Desmond Doss, but which is why we have such a high rate of veteran post-traumatic stress, veteran suicide, because we do get a lot of individuals who did not have the courage to say, hey, I don't feel comfortable in this environment, and were forced into environments not usually of their own control. And unfortunately, the moral injury is clear.
Wow. Gloria, Dwight, unmute yourself. What a great answer. Go ahead, Dwight.
Thank you, Jacob. I'm impressed that the Army does such a great job, only it doesn't turn out enough chaplains. I wanted to pursue the PTSD issue a little. Several years ago, we had a personal theology presentation from Jeremy Taylor, who has since passed away, but he felt there was a moral component to PTSD. The unconscious mind is upset that killing was involved, whether you killed or somebody tried to kill you, that's against our innate nature. And he thought that the terrible dreams that some people have is the unconscious mind trying to come to grips with this issue. Do you see any reality to that, or is that just pipe dreaming?
No, yeah. Unfortunately, the VA still does not have there's no moral injury disability rating. That's for, if we're looking at it at the reality, there is no moral injury disability rating. There's a disability rating for having post-traumatic stress, which is a clinically identifiable tool that clinicians have been using for the last 20 years. And PTSD is not anything new. One only needs to read books even from the 20th century, All Quiet on the Western Front, Seth Allenberger's Sniper on the Eastern Front. And moral injury has been in our species for thousands of years. It just hasn't been as well written about or as well documented until the last 20 years, unfortunately, on the backs of America's sons and daughters. Moral injury is now making the realms across the clinical realm. And unfortunately, from what I experienced at the chaplain course, is a lot of clinicians don't really know how to tackle that issue. PTSD isn't necessarily easier to treat, but it's easier to define in a clinical realm of this person's having waking nightmares from this clear trauma. They're getting creative virtuality headsets. They're doing actual exposures now where they try to not necessarily relive the exact experience, but close enough so that way they can feel that sense of control and empowerment. Because that's what PTSD really, it's a big part of what it does. It takes your control out of it, but you don't even realize you're out of control, like that you don't have a handle on it. Moral injury, I would say, is something that is where the spiritual and chaplains have been empowered by the Army now and across the provider realm to help address. I mean, moral injury is well within our wheelhouse. I mean, even after the prophets of Baal lost and were executed, the executor said, I don't agree with this. What God, why are you asking me to do this? That's not post-traumatic stress. That's moral injury right there. It's well within our wheelhouse. And so at the course, they shared with us a lot of readings on moral injury that necessarily wasn't to the rise of post-traumatic stress. And that's where the clinical counterpart comes at. Because if it rises above, generally the rule of thumb they give us, if it's something that can't be resolved in a 1 to 2 hour session by a chaplain or spiritual leader, it probably rises to the level of a clinician. Now, that obviously is dependent. Like if someone loses their parent, that's not going to get solved in an hour. Is that necessarily leading to post-traumatic stress? No, there's obviously that spectrum. But there are there are times where it is okay to have moral misgivings about an issue. And that's why chaplains in the military are the only ones you can go to. So this is the entire military. So if you have moral misgivings about killing or doing any action that the Army has had you do, if you go to anyone else besides a chaplain, they're a mandatory reporter. Let that sink in. So I already told you how short chaplains are across the U.S. military and how unfortunately difficult it is to reach them even within a battalion. So if they go to any other service member, now obviously it's not always that level of extreme, but that is the reality, is if they give anything that is a moral nature that would go against what the Army wants to be done. And so that's why I experienced when I was in Tucson, is I was having moral misgivings about arresting women and children, especially after my experiences going through foster care. Did I have PTSD from that? No. Did I have severe moral misgivings that was kind of keeping me up at night? Yes. And the only person I can go speak to, there wasn't even an Army chaplain available. I had to go to an Air Force base to find an Air Force chaplain to speak with as part of my journey. And did the Air Force chaplain necessarily agree with everything? No, but he understood. Moral injury wasn't in my lexicon at that time. It is now, but for many of our service members, they're not. And so that's why the Army has added it now as a regulation: moral, spiritual, or ethical. That was never in the Army's lexicon, and the Army is now making it in its lexicon, and the VA is hopefully going to follow here shortly. And VA chaplains are already adding it to their lexicon. So,
Bob.
This might sound like a quibbling question. Well, first of all, I'm really sorry I missed your first presentation here, because I really, really, really appreciate what you provided. My brother was a chaplain's assistant when he was in the Army.
There,
I avoided it by going in the Peace Corps. I was kind of a fork in the road. It was one or the other. The question is, it's kind of might seem theoretical, but I personally don't experience it that way anymore, or if I ever did. You use the term when you're referring to people as individuals. And I understand individual in a science-y kind of way as being the last undividable unit. But individual is also emphasized being separate. And so that's why I prefer using the word person instead of individual. And I know, you know, it's a commonplace use that, you know, most people don't take much meaning in, but I, as a chaplain, you're more interested in their personhood than their separateness from anybody else, you know, the unique separateness. And I just, it's something I picked up from the way you talk, and all your work, everything you described is certainly about dealing with people in their more complete personhood than just their military job. Or your military job too. So that's just something that struck me as you were talking. So, boy, I wish you the best with whatever you end up doing.
Yeah, that's definitely a balance military chaplains have. The reality is the entire reason why we have military chaplains is it stood up to congressional inquiry. It stood up to Supreme Court inquiry of why do we have religious leaders in a governmental institution? What happened to that separation of church and state? And the balance is we can't force people to go halfway across the world and take away their First Amendment rights. And we also have to give an outlet for them to express that First Amendment rights in a private confidential setting. Because when you're wearing the uniform of any U.S. military branch, you don't have an opinion. That is the that we've seen time and time again in the last year of Black Lives Matter protests, of people both for and against that nature, but stating those comments in uniform and being removed from the military service. Now, obviously, I would hope there would be more defense of those defending BLM, but unfortunately, the army is very black and white at times. You shall not, does not leave room for interpretation. And so the kind of the cynical view as well with the army and why they care about counseling is the army doesn't really care necessarily if someone's having misgivings about doing an action. They only care about, is that individual willing to do that action the next day and the next day and the next day? And so a big part of the chaplains is sometimes I'll have commanders and leaders reach out and say, hey, I have this guy with this issue. Can you solve it and let me know when it's done? And and that identifier is, I have this soldier that has an issue. Can you resolve it? But let me know when it's resolved. Not that takes away the army is interested in, is that service member going to be able to go back to work the next day? And some people in the chaplain corps are probably more concerned about necessarily bringing them back into the fight. I mean, I'm sure it looks really good on promotion points, which in case you haven't gotten the gist, I don't really care about getting promoted in the chaplain corps. It's not what I joined for, but for me, it's finding that balance of, I am interested in the personhood. That person's only going to be in the army for maybe 3 years, 10 years. Like in the grand scheme of the scope of their life, the army is only going to be a small part. I'm not really interested in getting them back into that fight the next day. If I will be the advocate, if I say, hey, they need to get out. They need, this isn't the environment for them. It's nothing personal. It's working with them. And I'm sure that's going to not get me a lot of goodwill towards me in the future. And I've already kind of experienced that with some service members I've worked with, but at the reality is, our EU values compel me. And that's a big part people forget about chaplains, is the army is not what keeps me in the chaplaincy. No, military chaplains are not actually kept in by the army. They're kept in by the ordained endorser. So if the UUA or members of the EU community at any point felt I was doing actions that goes against our values, they can pull my endorsement. Within 30 days, the army has to let me go, even if we're in a wartime environment. So that is the power that faith traditions have. And so when people ask for that separation of church and state, the argument made with the chaplain corps is it actually gives more citizen control of the military. I mean, what other job in the military do you think of that citizens, average citizens, can say, hey, they're doing something wrong, we need to stop it. There's no other rapport other than sending a letter to your senator and hoping that whatever pot of money they're being funded in is allows them to speak on it. So yeah, that's why I definitely care about that holistic side. And now when commanders argue with me, I can literally reference, hey, it's an army regulation, and that they don't like hypothetical. They like cut and dry black and white regulation. And I pull at least once a day when I'm in the uniform, I pull that regulation out of my hat.
Wow. Thank you for that question, Bob and Jacob. So Bob, to answer you, Jacob's talk from 2020 is on our website, up on our menu. I'll send you the link because it's a personal learning, personal theology archives. So you can get to hear. Jacob, I feel as though this is a seminal video that you've done that will affect the lives of young people. And so not only will the audio be up on our website, but I'm going to talk to our webmasters here, Jim Gasparini, to help get it up on YouTube, but unpublished, and you have the link. This is good. I think the UUA needs to see it.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely brilliant. Young people need to see it, that, and you need to be able to give this video to people when they're thinking through things. I've been to church today. I'm blown away by not only your commitment and the journey that you've done and this, the digging out of your own thing, staying solid in you, Unitarian Universalism as a father, as a husband, as a, you know, as a man, I'm just incredibly encouraged. And I got information that I would have never have known. Mm-hmm. So I will, I say, work with us getting this on YouTube, but you'll have the private link because it's your face. So on our website, it's just the audio, you know, because we don't put that up there. I just want to thank you. This has been astounding. Additional questions, comments?
I wanted to echo that, Jacob. Thank you so much. I'm so impressed that in spite of the difficulties you've had as a younger person, there's the part of you that's, you know, protected and guarded yourself, but then there's that part of you that's really curious and interested in learning and, you know, turning the rocks over and looking underneath and absorbing whatever you are able to learn and incorporating it into your life and moving forward. And I just really admire that and appreciate it so much. So I just wish you all the best in the future and please don't burn out.
Oh, no. We're not going to burn out here.
Yeah, we need you.
Yeah. So, Karen, Judy actually had her hand raised, and so I was going to put her in right next to Wendy. So just for you to know, and Jacob is also willing. Well, he is now because I made it so that, you know, if you have a question that, you know, he can write up afterwards. So, you know, if you send the questions to Anne, she can forward them to Jacob. Wendy, go ahead. We're going to go to 10:50 because this is too powerful. So we've got a few minutes to get a bunch of questions in. All right. So Wendy, go ahead.
So I mostly just wanted to congratulate you on being on a really good path. I feel like I have been called to be in a challenging environment. And it took me about 50 years to figure that out and to figure out that I had to do self-care and how to do self-care and have some boundaries about that. You know, if you want to say anything about that or whatever, but the sense of I keep on ending up in these situations, so there must be a reason.
I've been asked that question by obviously I, as military chaplains were there for all, so most of the demographic is 18 to 25. Once you get past that point, most people in leadership positions, they've been in the military for 20 to 30 years, and so they're about 40 to 60. The maximum military age is about 65. Some skirt around it a year or so, but so most. And so when I'm speaking with those individuals, I'm also there for them. So chaplains are not there for just the youngest service member. They're there for the oldest. And I think the recommendation I can give is it's how old was Saul on his road to Damascus? I mean, his what, 40s, 50s? Nowhere in any of the religious texts does it say after you hit 30, you're done. I mean, there might be the old Benjamin Franklin quote that made the rounds a few years ago of many people live till 25 and exist until they're 70. But the reality is we're not that society anymore. I mean, we have a president now who's the oldest president we've ever had, and in our lifetime that record's going to be broken. That is where we're living longer. Our medical care is rising up, and a lot of this science that is now coming out was not available 30, 40 years ago. I mean, self-care has only been in our lexicon for the last 2 years, and it took an entire worldwide pandemic to show our society as a whole, like, you know, we need to take better care of ourselves. I mean, yes, self-reliance has been out for 100 years, but most people didn't read that because there was wasn't as friendly overtones as self-care, the word self-care is. So no, you're doing the right thing by recognizing that. And for it speaks volumes to your character that even at this point in your life, you're still able to have that introspection and recognize the need for change. That's exactly what UU helps foster. Is there's you might start with one belief, and 20 years from now, you know, people change, or our neurons are not, don't stop growing until the day the brain ceases to exist. It might get harder as we age, but it doesn't stop. So
thank you. I want to get Judy's question in. That was great. Thank you, Wendy, for that. Judy, go ahead.
Thanks. I just wanted to compliment you, Jacob, also. This was a fabulous sermon. And I'm so impressed with all the information and knowledge you've got packed into your head, and that you can bring up, you know, when you refer to it and you need to tell people about it. But I was very interested, since my brother-in-law is a Navy man, has been, he's retired now, but and we used to have real fights, verbal fights, about religion and faith. When I asked him once, what do you think of our president? It was, I think it may have been Reagan. He said, well, he's my commander in chief, so I'll do whatever I'm asked to do. And I didn't know for sure why he said that very noncommittally until you told me. I've learned that now, that he would have been tossed out. But I'm interested in personal things about that have changed maybe for you or your family. Is your family more able to understand you, or are you not even, I didn't hear your first talk, so I don't want to go where it's not too comfortable for you, but I'm wondering if this has changed any of your previous affiliations with people you cared about.
Yeah. The hardest part, well, for keeping personal relations is with the military, it's hard to maintain friends outside because you move around so much. That's just the reality. Military friends, I hadn't seen a military friend in like 4 years, and I traveled back home to Nebraska this past winter, and it was like we had seen each other yesterday. In regards to the like political differences, is for me personally, it's just even though I'm only drilling 2 times a month, just politics was just never my cup of tea. Maybe later in life it will be, but I can say for like the last president, for me, that was really challenging because half my family really supports and loved everything he did. Obviously I disagreed with everything he did, except making attacking animals a felony. That one was a-okay, but the everything else, moral misgivings. But for me, it's exactly what you experienced with your friend, is, and I kind of alluded to earlier, as an officer, we're expected to obey the president. But when it comes to constitutionally antithetical items, that's why we had people forget that at the January 6th insurrection, the National Guard asked to be there, and they weren't denied, they were delayed because they hadn't gotten the approval, but the National Guard recognized the volatility of the situation, didn't care about the politics one way or the other. They recognized, hey, there's a large gathering that could potentially become violent and we want to help. And our military has to be apolitical. There has never been really a time in human history where the military acting as a political arm has borne fruit. Now, there are times where the US military has had to declare martial law in certain areas mainly, but it's always been a clear transference of power. We've seen time and time again, we can even see the examples of Myanmar, what happens when there isn't that peaceful balance of power, which all constitutions across the world most encourage, outside of North Korea, the military being a separate institution by design.
All right, I'm going to pop in here. Helen, we've got 2 minutes in Jacob's response. So go ahead with your question and then we'll end our session.
This will be very quick, but you must have heard from people that you have worked with how refreshing it is to have an open-minded religion. And to that they can be accepted in various degrees of belief or unbelief. What have you had that reaction from many people?
Great question.
Yeah, I've definitely, I get asked by when service members ask me what's the faith tradition, I tell them Unitarian Universalist. They look at me in confusion, like what is that? Like anything other than the term Christian is just gonna, they're 18 years old, it's gonna get that answer. And so it's kind of twofold is we're not there to convert, but if a service member asks a genuine question, all faith traditions are welcome to encourage. And obviously me being a chaplain, it's to be expected that I'd be willing to share what religious tradition has got me here in this uniform. Cause obviously, as I mentioned earlier, a faith tradition is the only thing keeping me there. And I've had a bunch of service members share that. Like they're like, I grew up in one tradition. I had misgivings, but I would always be interested in attending church. And I have shared local congregations with individuals. Just, I was never able to verify if they attend, but no, UU does having the way I view UU is essentially the way the Army views having the chaplain corps entirely. There has been outside of UU historically in our society, there's never been any outlet for people that are kind of in that other or none or what version of Christianity am I to be able to freely explore. The way I view UU is it's kind of a springboard. I mean, look at UU's influence on the pagan movement. I mean, we supported these covens, these groups in UU congregations. I've read many congregations renting out their basements for free to allow these groups to support. And now they're springboarding into their own groups with their own buildings. Does that harm UU's goal? No. That is exactly what we are here for. I am not interested in making more Unitarian Universalists. I'm interested in what they need to help them live the best life that they can. If that is UU, great. If that's one of the very miscellaneous pagan practices or Wiccan practices, that's great. If it's revamping their belief in the faith tradition they left and letting them know that, yes, they're loved. Yes, it's okay to be who they are. All the world's faith traditions actually do, if you read the texts and the academic rapport, do support in some instances LGBTQ. So I've had many of those discussions with service members and helped revoke their faith. So that's the way I view UU's part in it all.
Wow. Okay, thank you so much. I'm still raising my hand. I'm having hallelujah moments. Jacob, this has been absolutely exquisite. So reaffirming about Unitarian Universalism. You know, everybody here knows my thing is like, I follow the Jewish boy. That's how we got Christianity. That's how we got Unitarian Universalism. And these UUs walk their talk and you are walking your talk. You have our support. You have our love. You know, you can write to Ann at any time and say, listen, I need this community and we have your back for whatever reason as you go along. Please know that.
Yeah, you can come back and talk with us anytime.
And we will
we'll be your fan club.
Right. Every one of these people are 6 degrees away from somebody who has power, if we don't personally. So you let us know what you need. All right, my friends, this has been a wonderful morning, Jacob. Thank you so much. Yeah,
thank you again. And thanks everyone that managed to change their clock and time to be here. I really appreciate that you would do that.
Thank you guys for having me. It was a pleasure. And as Ann mentioned, if you have any other questions, I'm always open to answering. So
absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you.